from the number one sports site in the world. Yahoo! This is Yahoo Sports Radio. YahooSportsRadio.com.
Welcome to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
The boy Yelovich is an own goal! It's an own goal!
With your host, Joe Maka. From Yahoo Sports and Yahoo Sports Radio.
It's five! It's a landslide!
Joe Maka and all the insiders from the FC Yahoo Soccer Blog bring you coverage of soccer across the world.
Premier League,
MLS,
Champions League,
La Liga,
Serie A,
and Bundesliga. It's all the coverage from soccer across the world.
This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast.
Oh, it's going in!
Right now.
Incredibly, within seconds.
From the Yahoo Sports headquarters in Playa Vista, California, here's your host, Joe Maka.
Greetings, soccer fans. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, now available on iTunes. I'm Joe Maka, editor of the FC Yahoo blog. Joining me in the Playa Vista podcasting room here in Los Angeles is the one and only Shahan Ahmed.
Hello, hello, hello.
Welcome back, Shahan. And in New York, as always, we welcome Leander Charlakens.
I feel like in Joey Gallino's absence, we should say something about Batman against Superman, but I don't really feel like it.
We want people to listen to this podcast, Leander, so we will forego the Batman-Superman conversation. Guys, league play in Europe resumes this weekend with some big matchups, the biggest being El Clasico, Barcelona against Real Madrid at the Camp Nou on Saturday. And the U.S. men's national team just completed an emotional 4 days in World Cup and Olympic qualifying. But we're going to begin with some things that U.S. soccer is concerned about, namely their own women's national team. On Thursday, five players, including Carly Lloyd, Hope Solo, and Alex Morgan, announced on the Today Show, oddly enough, that they had filed a complaint with a federal Equal Employment Opportunity Commission against U.S. soccer, claiming wage discrimination relative to the U.S. men's national team. The players argue that they are more popular than the U.S. men's national team players and drive more revenue than what they are compensated for. According to the USWNT players, the U.S. Soccer Federation will not make its financial statements available. Let's turn to Leander, our national team, U.S. national team expert, for his insight. Leander, how did this mess reach these proportions? How did it get so bad?
Well, this is something that's been brewing a long time, and we have to track back a little bit to 2006, which was the last time that the women's national team actually negotiated a collective bargaining agreement with the federation. That expired in 2012, and in 2013, they signed a memorandum of understanding with slightly renewed terms. They've been fighting in court already after U.S. Soccer filed a suit against the players about whether that memorandum of understanding is actually valid and prevents the players from going on strike. This obviously would be a very big deal as it's an Olympic year, and in women's soccer, that's the second biggest tournament. So there's already been sort of this slumbering talk of strikes and labor strife. And the New York Daily News this week had a really interesting article on how the women's national team players don't actually know what kind of money the federation is generating from their games because their finances are so opaque. It's all tied up with Soccer United Marketing, which is an arm of Major League Soccer, which is then sort of in bed with U.S. soccer. And it's really hard for them to tell how much money they're actually making. And so they don't know if they're getting a fair deal. They're arguing that they're more successful than the men's national team, which is pretty hard to refute. But in spite of that, the men's national team gets per game bonuses of up to $17,000 for friendlies, whereas the women only get $1,350 if they win. If they lose, they get nothing, whereas the men, when they lose, they sometimes still collect $5,000 each. And so you've got these wild discrepancies in their bonuses. It must be said here that the women's national team draws a salary, but that's about $72,000 at the most. So the men's national team players are paid a lot more. U.S. soccer... let's start from right from that point. U.S. Soccer points to the fact that FIFA gives them much smaller winning bonuses for World Cups because there's an inequality there at FIFA. FIFA will also, by the way, not divulge how much money it's making from the women's team. But so now the women want to get this federal commission to look into U.S. soccer's finances and take a hard look at what they're actually making from the women's team. Because they feel, and there's even some documentation from U.S. soccer itself that supports this, that they're not getting their fair share of the revenues, that the men get a lot more money, which isn't really being disputed, for doing the same job, even though they don't bring in as much money to the federation as the women do.
So how far are the women's players willing to take this? Could they actually strike, and could they threaten not to play in the summer games in Rio de Janeiro?
Well, they'd already established in the CBA and Memorandum of Understanding dispute that they would be willing to go on strike, and that's exactly why U.S. Soccer sued them just for that. The women then countersued and now have brought this complaint against U.S. Soccer for the wage discrimination. But they have said again, and they reiterated that they would not rule out going on strikes. So it's definitely a possibility, and it's understandable that they won't take that off the table, because in an Olympic year, they have a little bit of leverage which they otherwise wouldn't have.
So this has been, well, this talk of inequality with the women's team, it's not just the money. There's been a lot of coverage and the players themselves on social media characterizing or documenting the inequality over just the turf, the conditions, the practice fields. Megan Rapinoe hurt herself in Hawaii, suffered a really bad knee injury on this dodgy pitch that they're forced to play on. We all remember from the World Cup the frustration over having to play an entire World Cup on turf in Canada. So this, you know, we were talking about this leads to a larger discussion over whether female and male athletes should make the same amount of money if the revenue is not equal. Shahan, do you have any perspective on that?
Yeah, I mean, you know, everyone thinks back to the World Cup where we saw the image of the female soccer player who'd slid tackled on the turf and had her. I remember, you know, I also cover the Lakers. And I remember Kobe Bryant actually retweeted that picture and basically called out the Women's World Cup for not having grass pitches, because anyone who's played the sport understands the difference, especially when you're playing slide tackle. I mean, it's night and day. You genuinely, anytime you slide tackle, you just rip up your legs. Mm-hmm. So it's as on a professional level, it doesn't make sense to on an event that big. I actually on this particular issue, I think the women probably have the right of way. I don't think it's necessarily the same across all sports and a lot across all spectrums. You know, we recently had that incident with Serena Williams at Indian Wells, where the CEO came out and basically said, you know, the women should get on their knees and thank God for Djokovic and Federer being around for the last decade. And, you know, at Indian Wells, it didn't make sense, because in the U.S., Serena Williams is a bigger draw in tennis than the men are, but worldwide that's not necessarily the case. So for tennis, it was a little bit odd. I think it kind of goes back and forth. It should probably be event to event. For soccer in the U.S., I don't think there. I mean, if you walk down the street when the women are playing, there is more interest than when the men are playing on most games. Especially, you know, okay, during the Men's World Cup, everybody got all types of crazy and into it because the men actually got a few results, and you know, we'll. I think for the women in particular in this case, they do generate enough of interest that the finances should be made public. And if they are generating more money than the men, perhaps they should get paid more than the men rather than equal pay.
I've always felt that the U.S. women's national team is at times more popular than the men's team. And I could see it in our traffic. You know, the Women's World Cup generated, of all of our coverage, I want to say close to 40 million page views, it just in the FC Yahoo blog alone. So, I mean, that's a massive number. How that compares to, you know, the Men's World Cup, it's not it's apples to oranges because we had way more people covering. We invested more. We had sponsorships to cover Brazil 2014. But I always felt that – and it's because one thing, the U.S. women's national team, they have faces. You know, the one face for the U.S. men's team was Landon Donovan. The U.S. women's team, and to the – you know, they're the first ones. They've actually won a World Cup. But they've always had a face on their teams, whether it was Mia Hamm, you know, Abby Wambach and Alex Morgan. I think in the mainstream, the U.S. women's team has more attention, is more popular. Whether they make more money, we don't know because U.S. Soccer won't make those financial statements available. But
the one thing I wanted to add was, you know, I was talking about the pitches earlier. I mean, on a global scale, obviously the men's game is much, much, much bigger. So, but in the U.S., I think the feeling that I get and the numbers that you just talked about back it up. But I think it does come down to the female stars are more marketable. They seem to be in this sport, anyhow. Because I mean the male. I mean you're right. Michael Bradley's been around, and he's one of the few names that you could say. But he hasn't really been marketed the way, you know, Abby Wambach has or even Megan Rapinoe has, or I think.
Well, we don't know how. I mean, does that translate into more revenue? We don't.
Well, I think there's one country, maybe two, in the world where the women's national team is more popular than the men's national team. And the U.S. is one, and Canada might be another, but I'm not even entirely sure. But I think there's two debates to be had here, and one of them is if women in their sport are doing the same job as men in that same sport, but they're driving less revenue. Are they entitled to equal pay? I mean, that's one part of it. And the other part here is it's hard to say what the women are making. If you actually look at some of the budget projections that were in the filing of the complaint, it's looking like U.S. Soccer projected to make more money in 2016 and 2017 from what it calls women's national team events. So that's games, I think, for the most part, outside of the FIFA scope. And that's tournaments, etc. And in 2017, they're projecting something like $8 million more from the women's team than the men's team. And in 2016, this year, it's something like $2.5 million more. Now, that doesn't mean that in terms of sponsorship and broadcast rights and merchandise and all that stuff, they're also making more from the women. And that might even it out. But it suggests that at the very least, the women are close. And when you look at the bonus structure and when you look at what they're actually taking away, when you include that full-time salary and sort of the whole package, the men are making more considerably, even though the women, even from what we can tell without having the full information, are definitely close to earning what the men are if they're not making what much more, which is a possibility. Because you see a lot of Alex Morgan jerseys out there, and I think more of them than you see Clint Dempsey jerseys.
Leander, how do you think this is all going to end, how it's going to shake out?
It's really hard to predict because I don't know that we've ever been here before. I mean, it's been a decade since the women last negotiated a CBA with U.S. Soccer. I don't imagine that we can rule out them going on a strike in the preparation for the Olympics. I don't think they'll sit out the Olympics. I think that would be extreme. I don't think anybody wants that, especially because the women's calendar is skewed so weirdly, where they have a Women's World Cup 1 year and then the Olympics the next year and then nothing basically for 3 years until the next Women's World Cup. So it would be such a missed opportunity for the players, you know, not just in terms of name recognition, but also endorsements and branding. And particularly from sort of a competitive standpoint, I don't see them sitting it out. But I think this could be one of those things that goes down to the wire.
So we're going to end this conversation with a tweet from Landon Donovan. He just tweeted an hour ago. There's this discussion on Twitter. He said, "I'm not for equal pay. I'm for fair pay. If hashtag USWNT generate more revenue, they should be paid more."
He also said that, you know, soccer is a business. Unlike, he said it's not like social work or a government job, which I thought was a weird comparison because those are very much businesses as well in their own way. So, you know, he's kind of pointing to the fact that it should be tied to what kind of revenue you bring in. And again, that's the larger discussion, I think, between pay equality between men's and women's sports. And he seems to be coming down on the side where you're entitled to what you bring in. But for a lot of women's sports, that would be a pretty raw deal.
Yeah, I'll just end with, you know, I also cover basketball. I mean, the NBA and WNBA are probably the best examples of where I don't think it should be equal pay for the same or equal pay for the same play, because I mean, you go to the same arenas and one of them selling out and you're paying a premium to get a ticket to just get in the house. The other one, you genuinely could probably get it for a couple bucks on the street if you hopped up to the arena, because there's so many empty seats, nobody is at the games.
All right, guys, let's switch gears to the U.S. men's national team. The U.S. men had two World Cup qualifiers against Guatemala last Friday in Guatemala City, and a home match last Tuesday in Columbus, Ohio. And the Americans shockingly lost 2-0 in Guatemala to ignite an outrage not seen before during Jurgen Klinsmann's reign as U.S. men's national team coach. So faced with a must-win game to keep their hopes of reaching Russia 2018 alive, USA came through with a 4-0 victory over Guatemala, the 95th ranked team in the latest FIFA World Rankings. Here is what Klinsmann said after the 4-0 win in Ohio about his controversial team selection.
I'm cool with that, you know. I let people say whatever they would like to say. That's all right with me. I mean, here and there you wish maybe some comments could be a little bit more respectful. But it is what it is. It's an emotional game, and emotions always go both ways. You know, when things go well, their emotions go, like, you know, in Brazil, they go skyrocketed suddenly. And if you lose a game, then, you know, some comments go the other direction. And you just, as a coach, you have to live with that, and you got to keep your balance, which I do. It's not a big deal. But I think, you know, this result tonight makes it clear. Now we can kind of really plan for hopefully a very, very exciting Copa America where we want to do well, and definitely we will learn a lot of things in the upcoming months.
So, guys, my question to you is everything as peachy as Klinsmann suggests?
Things are not peachy. The U.S. had not lost to Guatemala City since January 10th, 1988. After that, they went on a 21-game run where they never lost to Guatemala. Actually, 3 days after that 1988 loss, they beat Guatemala in Guatemala City. It was such an embarrassing, humiliating, and awful display. And then they win 4-0, and now, you know, Klinsmann sort of acting like he's vindicated and everything is okay because they won, and they'll probably go through to the hexagonal round, and chances are that they will qualify for the World Cup from there. But that doesn't take away the fact that, you know, this national team, well, not a fact, I suppose, but an opinion, that this national team is a shambles right now, that he's constantly playing guys out of position, that it has no identity, it has no core, it has no partnerships or familiarity on the field, because he's constantly shuffling around the lineups and the pairings. And that's to say nothing of the under-23s not qualifying for the Olympics again for a third time in four cycles. You know, the under-17s missing out on the World Cup for the first time a few years ago. The under-20s doing okay, but not really setting the world on fire either. The U.S. getting some decent prospects coming through European academies like Borussia Dortmund and Bayern Munich and Arsenal, but those guys, you know, not really making it into the senior national team again. So, you know, you look at the other side of Klinsmann's job as technical director, and that's going poorly as well. And I think overall, it's just a really bleak picture for the U.S. national team program at the moment.
Yeah, 2-0 to Guatemala. 2-0 to Guatemala. That's what the U.S. pulled off. I mean, okay, yes, in the rematch in the U.S., they win 4-0.
We're supposed to celebrate the fact that they beat Guatemala at home, right? Is that what
it was Guatemala.
Is that right now?
No offense to any Guatemalan listeners that we have out there, but the U.S.
had,
yeah. They're gone now. But I mean, so they win 4-0 at home, right? And you say, well, how do you lose 2-0 to the same team a week earlier? And, I understand. Home and away makes a big difference, but the level and, you know, quality and resources is night and day. And then you throw in the fact that, you know, earlier in that clip, that the part that we didn't play, Klinsmann is basically making excuses for players being in the MLS, players being in Europe, players being in Liga MX, so he has trouble getting squads. That's every national team around the world. That's how it works. It's players from different areas coming together for a short period of time. You're the coach. You put them together. They go out there. They play as one unit. And if they don't perform as one unit, that's your fault. Like, and, you know, I'll look at the example of Mexico. Mexico won the Gold Cup and fired their coach. Because that's the standard that they have. The U.S. loses the Gold Cup, then says, no, the Confederations Cup, that's the goal. Don't make it to that. It's like, no, that's fine. Lose 2-0 to Guatemala, come back and win 4-0, which
that is a very good point.
They were supposed to do the first time around anyway. But it's like, oh, no, everything's fine now. Everybody be cool. We're good.
Right. We have this constant lowering of the bar with Klinsmann at the helm. Like, we are supposed to be okay, you know, after a surprising, unexpected, shocking 2-0 loss in Guatemala, everything's supposed to be okay after they do what they're supposed to do to a Guatemala team that's ranked 95th. Now, so let's give Klinsmann credit for winning a must-win game, but if you look closer at how they won, okay, Jossie Zardes got a lot of attention on Twitter for one. Having a horrible first touch has nothing to do with Klinsmann. He's had that ever since he's been playing with the first 11 with the LA Galaxy. But he got two assists, one off his rear end, another was really accidental, just as accidental, off his thigh, and those led to goals. So it seems the U.S. was more lucky than good. I know you need to be both, especially when it comes to World Cup qualifying in CONCACAF, which is only getting tougher, but still, guys. I mean, let's be realistic about where the USMNT is at right now. Klinsmann finally realized that DeAndre Yedlin should be at right back. Injuries conspired against him to settle on a center back partnership. He got it right with Steve Birnbaum playing one of the center back spots. But still, you know what? What we can expect from Jurgen Klinsmann is the unexpected. We have no idea what he's gonna play, what formation. I know that's not an issue for you, Leander. Where they line up, but still, we are in this constant experimentation with Jurgen Klinsmann, and how are we supposed to believe that he will get it right for the Copa America?
Well, you know, you take a hard look at that game. You have one goal from a long ball that was diabolically defended and takes a good bounce for Clint Dempsey and goes in. You've got a set piece, and then you've got sort of, you know, two broken plays in the box where, again, the ball falls well and an American scores. You know, they didn't even create all that many more chances than they had in Guatemala City. It's just the difference was Guatemala was sort of effective on the counter and a little bit more aggressive in Guatemala City. Credit where it's due, a 4-0 win is a 4-0 win, but at the same time, the defense was still far from convincing. They were sloppy on the ball a lot, and it just wasn't all that good. And then you have to consider that a home win against Guatemala, rather than some big redeeming, vindicating comeback, is really the baseline of expectations here. I mean, it's the second to last round of qualifying. We're not even that far into this whole thing. There's a 16-game road for the U.S. to qualify for the World Cup, and that was game number 4. And the loss to Guatemala, loss in Guatemala City, was game number 3. I mean, for them to have gotten in trouble a quarter of the way down to what's, let's be honest, yes, it's hard to play in Central America a lot of the time, but CONCACAF is not a hard region to qualify from. Once you get into the hex, 3 out of 6 teams qualify directly, and the fourth goes to a playoff, which is what Mexico did, and they absolutely tonked New Zealand in that playoff. So for there to be so much doubt and so many issues this early on is really concerning. And they say that it happened, you know, in the last cycle as well, when the U.S. started 1-1-1. But, you know, I don't really believe in using all this previous mediocrity to justify more mediocrity.
U.S. soccer, to address the, I guess, the discussion around Jurgen's constant tinkering of the lineups. They floated out a stat comparing or illustrating how often Bob Bradley and Bruce Arena changed their lineup. Lander, do you have the – I don't know what the stat was offhand.
It was something like Klinsmann had used 78 different lineups in 80 games and Arena had used like 129 in 130, and Bob Bradley was very close as well. But and you might be getting to this, they didn't actually say how many changes they made in that lineup.
It could be one change. And the, so here's the issue. It's fine to make changes in your lineup, but that Bob Bradley team that went to South Africa, coming off the Confederations Cup, you know what the back line was. At least the center back pairing. It was Jay DeMeritt and Gooch on Yewu. You had Steve Cherundolo on the right. You knew at least three of the four spots. The left back has always been a sore spot for the U.S. With Klinsmann, you don't know. You know, we've mentioned this in the previous podcast. You really don't know who's going to be in his starting 11. We still don't know. But here's what you need. When you're constantly tinkering, you're constantly experimenting, there is no continuity. There is no chemistry.
No.
There's no familiarity with the left center back knowing what the right center back is going to do. And that's the heart of the problem, is that it's fine to try new players, try new things. But at some point, you need to come up with at least a core, a spine of a team. And he has yet to do that.
And it gets to the point now where when there's injuries, they don't even count as valid excuses to me anymore, because you don't know if those guys are going to be playing. It's not like you can say, other than Altidore and Bradley and Jermaine Jones when he's there, but not even really him anymore. And Clint Dempsey, you can't really say, maybe Fabian Johnson. You can't really say, oh, that guy's not there and he would have been a starter. So when they said, oh, well, Matt Beisler and John Brooks were scratched before the first game in Guatemala City, I don't even think that counts as an excuse anymore, because we really don't know if those guys would have even been in the lineup, just because he's so unpredictable, especially with his defensive pairings. I looked it up once and I can't remember it now, but his numbers for the amount of different defensive lineups he's used, how many different back fours he's had, is staggering. He's only reused the same back line once or twice. And now he's rotating his goalkeepers behind that back line as well, which makes it even harder for them to sort of settle in. I mean, it's like there's this perpetual turnover. How in the world are they supposed to forge a team out of that?
The pro-Klinsmann crowd will point to just how weak this talent pool, the senior team talent pool, is. But then you have some of, guys like Landon Donovan who are saying it's actually the deepest and most talented it's ever been. So what are we to make of this, excuse for Klinsmann that there isn't enough talent to build a – that's why he's constantly tinkering. He's looking for that right 11. Now, here's what I'll – for in – Klinsmann doesn't have a dominant team to draw from. Like, Germany has Bayern Munich. The Spain team has been drawing from Barcelona and Real Madrid. He has got the most maybe complicated pool to draw from, because MLS is what it is. There aren't that many Americans really emerging in Europe, except for a handful. The Jeff Camerons and the DeAndre Yedlins. I mean, is that an excuse? I just want to talk about this, the fact that people are alleging that the U.S. talent pool isn't good enough.
I'll just say one thing. You mean to tell me that Toronto FC isn't that wholesome American breeding ground?
Well, I'm not sure I buy that as an excuse for Klinsmann, because if you're not the national team of England, Italy, Germany, Spain, you're not going to have that sort of dominant team to draw from, because your players are going to be scattered all over the world. I mean, my home country, the Netherlands, certainly has players in like probably a dozen different leagues, just as Klinsmann does. So that's also, like Shahan was saying earlier, that's one of those things. that maybe he likes to point to, but that's actually a problem that every single national team coach has. I find it really hard to compare player pools between different generations, but you know, I think you can also say Dempsey is up there with the best forwards the U.S. has ever had. I don't think there's any question that Michael Bradley is the best midfielder the U.S. has ever had. Yeah, Donovan's gone, but Altidor, you know, as a target man, is he up there with guys like Wijnaldum and Brian McBride? Altidor, you know, is he the best striker the U.S. has ever had? No, but he's probably up there with Eric Wijnaldum and Brian McBride. I mean, this is a good team. You know, you've got Tim Howard, you've got Brad Guzan, you've got two goalkeepers who until recently were starters in the Premier League. You know, there's depth in every line and in every position, and even in what historically were problem positions. And again, it's hard to make like-for-like comparisons, but this doesn't strike me as a particularly weak pool, and certainly not a weak enough one where that becomes an excuse. And I think you can say that it's one of the stronger pools.
So in addition to World Cup qualifying, the U.S. had a playoff series against Colombia. They came away with a 1-1 draw in Colombia and then were eliminated. They lost the final spot of the 16-team field for the Rio Games in Frisco, Texas, 2-1. And, guys, is this the more... It should be more concerned about the future of U.S. soccer with the U.S. not making the Olympics for the second straight time. They haven't been to the U.S. men haven't been to a summer game since the Beijing Games in 2008. Leander, you wrote about in FC Yahoo that this would be a disaster if the U.S. did not qualify. Why is this so damaging for the U.S. men's program?
There are only so many quality competitive games that you're going to get as a youth national team player. And the Olympics are sort of the summit of that, especially because once you get to the Olympics, which again, the U.S. did in 2008, but didn't in 2012, 2016, or 2004, once you get there, there are overage players there. Every team gets three, and they tend to be really good. And so it's a very high-level tournament. And it's the kind of competition with full stadiums, which you certainly don't always get at under 20 and under 17 World Cups, and against teams that really want to win and that have been properly prepared, strong opposition. It's just a learning experience and a formative experience that's part of a youth national team career that's really sort of the summit of it. And, you know, so many national teamers who played in 2008, like Michael Bradley, have talked about what an important experience that was. And even teams that go three and out just have been there and have been through it. It's the closest simulation as a youth national teamer that you're going to get to a World Cup. And that's just such an important part of their education on their way to the senior national team. And U.S. is going to be missing it again.
Yeah, I'll just say one thing. I mean, 2012, who won? Mexico. U.S. can't even make the Olympics, and Mexico's winning the Olympics. I think that kind of shows you the closest neighbor and really the closest competition, or should be the closest competition, that's how far ahead they are, not just in expectations, but in actually results, too. And that is the problem. I mean, when you're looking at the Olympics, it's always about the future. And if you can't even make it to the Olympics, then that doesn't bode well for what's coming 8 years from now or 6 years from now. It's not a good look.
Is there an upside, if there is an upside, to this loss? Does it mean will these under 23 players be available for the Copa America? And if so, who could really make their way onto that squad in June?
They could be available, and they probably would have been available anyway, because Copa is in June and the World Cup the Olympics is in August. But you know, you've got guys like Jordan Morris and you know, Christian Pulisic, who was already with the senior team. Guys like that, I would expect Julian Green, maybe if he sort of turns his club season around. Guys like that, we could definitely be seeing with the senior national team, maybe even a goalkeeper like Ethan Horvath. But there's talent in that group, and that's kind of the frustrating thing with the under-23s and even with the under-20s, is there always seems to be talent in those groups, and they just don't put it together. It's a systemic problem across all the national teams.
Guys, let's take a timeout. After the break, we'll preview the weekend's big games, the biggest being El Clasico. Barcelona against Real Madrid. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, direct from the FC Yahoo Soccer blog at yahoosports.com. And if you're looking for a sports radio morning show that is just a little bit more entertaining and has a little bit of fun, along with all your coverage of sports every morning, check out the Steve Zabin Show, direct from Yahoo Sports Radio.
Possibility of more donuts to come.
Yes. A new donut at 7-Eleven. You want to take a guess as to the flavor of the donut?
A chocolate.
No, they got those.
Sriracha.
So it's new. Maple bacon.
Sriracha.
Everything's sriracha nowadays.
Sriracha it. Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah. Sriracha, tropical
sriracha
fruit.
Didn't even exist as a flavor when I was a kid. Another 7-Eleven staple.
Slurpee.
Yes. Ding, ding, ding. Slurpee flavored donuts.
But what flavor?
Slurpee's flavor?
What flavor Slurpee?
Yes. Yes, the red or cherry.
Steve Zabin, mornings, 6 a.m. until 10 a.m. Eastern on Yahoo Sports Radio. Listen live and check out the podcast of The Steve Zabin Show, yahoosportsradio.com. It's time to get back to everything, football and soccer from across the world. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. This is the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast from Yahoo Sports Radio and Yahoo Sports. Once again, your host, Joe Ago.
Welcome back to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. I'm Joe Lago, editor of the FC Yahoo Soccer blog. Here with me talking soccer are Shahan Ahmed and Leander Charlakins. Guys, the European leagues are back in action this weekend. The key matchups in England in the Premier League title race will be second place Tottenham at Liverpool on Saturday and league leader Leicester City at home against Southampton on Sunday. But the game everyone will be watching this weekend will be the big rivalry game in Spain, El Clasico between Barcelona and Real Madrid at the Camp Nou. Barcelona is running away with the La Liga title race. They hold a 10-point lead over third-place Real Madrid, 9 points over second-place Atletico Madrid. So why are we going to watch on Saturday, other than this ongoing coronation of Barcelona as La Liga champs?
Well, it's still Messi versus Ronaldo, right? That's still the main headline. But it's beyond that. I mean, you look at the top five leagues like scorers in La Liga, all five are going to be featured in this game. This is, you know, a goal scorer's wet dream, basically. You know, you really think about. You know, Ronaldo right now has 28 goals. Suarez at 26. Messi's at 22. Neymar's at 21. And Benzema's at 20. Atletico Madrid is actually third in terms of scoring in La Liga right now. And if you take Suarez and Messi, they have more goals than Atletico. You take Suarez and Neymar, they have more goals than Atletico. So you're looking at two guys on these teams can genuinely outscore the third best team in the league. And that's a Champions League team in the quarterfinals. You know, pretty good team overall, you would say. You know, Ronaldo, goal scoring wise, has still been able to do it this year. I know Real's still a little bit further back. And for the La Liga, I don't think that it matters even if Barcelona loses, even though they haven't lost since October. But let's say they do lose and Atletico wins this weekend and Real Madrid obviously would win this weekend. Then you're looking at Atletico being 6 points back, but really there's a tiebreaker, so it's 7 points back. Real Madrid would be 7 points back. You still have a 7-point gap with seven rounds to go. This team's has not lost since the start of October. You do not see them losing this lead. They're just not built to lose it. But I do think it's kind of a measuring stick, kind of a broken one at that, because they're coming off of international breaks and they have Champions League coming up, more important games early next week. So, were not El Clasico, this would actually be the opportunity to rest guys, to be honest with you. They really shouldn't be playing these guys. When you look into expectations for what these managers are going to put on these teams, you can't really think that Zidane would be judged by playing an El Clasico at Camp Nou in a game that is coming off international break where he's getting his players back on short rest after they've been zigzagging the world as well. And then he has a more important fixture coming up early next week. I don't think he would lose his job even if he somehow got a 4-0 like Rafa did, which I don't think he will, but let's just say he did. I just don't think that this is one of the more meaningless El Clasicos. But hey, star power still sells.
Yeah, for those who don't remember, Barca crushed Real Madrid 4-0 back in November. Leander, has this version of El Clasico lost its luster? Are you going to watch the Messi Suarez Neymar show?
I will absolutely be watching, but Shahan is right. This is the least relevant Clasico in as long as I can remember. But then the beauty of it is that, you know, in the running of Barca and Real Madrid, the Spanish and the Catalans aren't entirely rational. Even if there's nothing at stake, that is still the big game to them. And I do think that Zidane, I don't think he'll be fired if they lose 4-0, but I think it'll be held against him over the long term, because you're just not supposed to lose to Barcelona by a lot of goals. That's just all around something that's frowned upon, to say the least. I mean, it's still tribal. It's still Madrid against Catalunya. It's still the capital against the breakaway region. It's still 100 years of animosity and sabotage and rage, frankly. So, you know, all of those things will conspire, I think, to still make it a very good game. And, you know, if nothing else, Real is playing for pride a little bit after they did lose 4-0 at home. And so in that regard, it's a little bit unfortunate for the coaches, as you guys alluded to, the timing of this game, that it does come before these major, major Champions League quarterfinal games. I mean, Real Madrid may only have Wolfsburg, and they sort of got lucky in that sense. But Barcelona has Atletico Madrid next week. So next week, Tuesday. So on the one hand, they have to conserve powers. But on the other, this is the game where really no excuses are accepted. So it's tricky.
Yeah, I mean, I was saying, you know, I kind of said it's kind of a broken measuring stick. The Champions League games actually fit into that a little bit, because this may very well be a preview of a Champions League semifinal or the final itself, because you do expect Barcelona to get past Atletico because they've had the beating of them for the last season and a half, you would say, maybe even 2 seasons. I think I'd have to go back and check on that. This season, definitely. And then Real Madrid, you expect to get past Wolfsburg. And when you're looking at 4 teams left, it's the luck of the draw for the semifinal, or if they don't draw each other, let's say it's Barca-Bayern, which we would all love to see over 2 legs, then you probably expect, or you would give Real Madrid a pretty good chance of making it to the final. You know, it is genuinely a coin flip if they come up against PSG or whoever it may, or Man City, but I would probably go with PSG on that side. So I think that even though this may be one of the more meaningless Clasicos, it may set the stage for 2 of the more meaningful, or 1 meaningful Champions League final Clasico. So keep that in mind.
What should we expect on Saturday? Should we expect another Barcelona walkover over Real?
For me, I do think that, you know, when you look at the main guys for Barcelona, they've traveled longer distances, in that Messi, Suarez, and Neymar were all in South America. So I think there may be a little bit of sluggishness on that side. In terms of quality, I think that from what I've seen, or what I've been seeing in terms of reports, I think Real Madrid is going to go with their trident, the expensive players, in that Benzema, Bale, and Ronaldo are expect to all be starting up top, which is not something that's happened very often since Zidane took over, because Bale was out for a while and James was actually in form and playing well, but he expects to be on the bench along with Isco. So it kind of is one of those things where, yeah, it's at Camp Nou. The fact that it's in Barcelona gives them a healthy advantage. Those guys, I think on the balance, Barcelona is still a better team this year. So yeah, I mean, I expect them to score. I expect them to win. If they get a draw, it wouldn't be shocking, just considering, you know, the travel that's been involved, and it does take a toll on players. And you can't, it's hard to look past El Clasico, but 2 legs against Atletico are not going to be easy. Those are going to be really grueling matches.
So predictions? Oh, go ahead, Leander.
Yeah, I think so too. And the important thing is, I don't think Barca will take Atletico lightly, because 2 seasons ago, Atletico knocked Barca out in the Champions League, and you know, we're quick to forget that. But I agree with Shahan. I think Barca has just more going for it this year. I mean, it's just a better team right now, and I think there's more stability there, which you wouldn't believe it, but that's actually an important thing in soccer. even though Barca and Real sort of specialize in creating crises in their own clubs. But I don't see Real Madrid winning this or even taking a tie.
What's your prediction?
Yeah, I think I have Barcelona. I'll say Barcelona 3-1.
I'll say Barca 2-1. Leander, to get you
2-0.
On the record. 2-0. 2-0 for Leander. Well, guys, we got to go. Everyone, be sure to subscribe to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast, which is now available on iTunes. And you can find all of our insights on the beautiful game in the FC Yahoo blog on Yahoo Sports. For Shahan Ahmed and Leander Charlakens, I'm Joe Lago. You have been listening to the FC Yahoo Soccer Podcast. Thanks. Talk to you next time.